On December 31st, 2019, the World Health Organization China Country Office was informed about a novel coronavirus outbreak in a seafood market in Wuhan. Less than 3 months later, the World Health Organization declared the novel coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, or COVID-19, a pandemic. At first, a vaccine for COVID-19 seemed impossible. There had never been a vaccine for a coronavirus in human history, and the fastest development of a vaccine had taken 4 years. Then, when promising reports of early human trials began to surface in the summer of 2020, so did news of widespread vaccine hesitancy worldwide. To learn more about vaccine hesitancy and how to combat it, we spoke to infectious disease researcher Mallory Ellingson.
Hi, I'm Mallory Ellingson. I am an infectious disease epidemiologist and doctoral student at the Yale School of Public Health. My research focuses mostly on vaccine acceptance and vaccine communication.
On December 2nd, 2020, only 337 days after the virus's discovery, the UK became the first country to approve a vaccine for the COVID-19 virus, followed closely by the US, Canada, and numerous other countries. However, despite finally being presented with a form of defense against COVID-19, vaccine hesitancy continues to persist in the general public.
So I think it really depends on how you define or think of vaccine hesitancy. I think what pops into most people's minds immediately is the idea of the anti-vaxxers, the people who you see out protesting who are, vehemently anti-vaccine. That's very uncommon. That's a very, very small but vocal portion of the population. When we talk about vaccine hesitancy in the research world, we're sort of referring to anybody who has any little bit of hesitancy about vaccines. And that can be anything as simple as a question or two when you go in to get vaccinated, to maybe wanting to delay or potentially considering refusing a vaccine. And that tends to be a lot more common. And I think for the COVID-19 vaccine specifically, at least in the United States, our most recent polls are showing that up to 40% of the general public are saying that they are planning to either delay or refuse the COVID-19 vaccine altogether. So that's, definitely worrying to me, and I would consider that pretty prevalent in the population. I'm very, very concerned if those 40% of people really do decide to not get the vaccine, and if even more people decide to wait and delay getting vaccinated, that's going to just prolong the pandemic and every day that we spend not attempting to reach some level of herd immunity is another day that more people die. And it's a blunt way to put it, but it's true that just every person who turns down a vaccine is potentially prolonging the pandemic.
In October 2020, the Stat-Harris poll revealed only 58% of Americans were willing to receive a COVID-19 vaccine, down from 69% from mid-August. This statistic becomes more concerning when considering the importance of herd immunity. Herd immunity is a form of group resistance against an infectious disease and is achieved when there are high proportions of immunity throughout the population. Herd immunity is important as it provides indirect protection to individuals that may not be eligible for the vaccine, which we will discuss in a future episode. Due to difficulties in determining how contagious COVID-19 really is, there is uncertainty regarding the percentage of individuals that need to be vaccinated to achieve herd immunity. However, the leading COVID-19 vaccines are reporting around 95% efficacy. For reference, measles and polio vaccines have efficacies of nearly 100% after multiple doses and have historically required 95% and 80% vaccination rates for herd immunity, respectively. When only a little over half the population is willing to be vaccinated, that becomes a problem. And what makes this problem more challenging to tackle is the diversity in the vaccine-hesitant population.
There is a lot of diversity in the vaccine hesitant population. It's not necessarily defined by a single characteristic or even a single concern or a single question about vaccines. There are sort of a myriad of different reasons why a person might be vaccine hesitant. And like I said, it can range from just a couple of questions to these extreme anti-vax individuals. So for those, what we call kind of the fence sitters or the only slightly hesitant people, that's just about everybody. I think one of the misconceptions about vaccine hesitancy is that it's automatically a bad thing or that you're a bad person if you're vaccine hesitant. That's definitely not the case. We do see there is a higher level of vaccine hesitancy, at least in the United States, among minority populations. That tends to come from a lack of trust in the medical system, a lack of trust in the public health system. And at least in the United States, there are, I mean, far more incidents than I can even list. You know, there are some of the more sort of famous violations of trust and violations of the minority community, such as the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, J. Marion Sims and his experimentation on African-American women. I could unfortunately go on and on and on.
The Tuskegee syphilis experiment, conducted by the United States Public Health Service and the Centers for Disease Prevention, deliberately left 600 Black American men from Tuskegee University untreated with syphilis to study its progression for 40 years between 1932 and 1972. The study misled the participants into believing they were receiving free healthcare from the government while disguising placebos and ineffective methods as treatment. By the end of the study, 128 participants had died due to syphilis or its complications. James Marion Sims, once lauded as the father of modern gynecology, conducted his research by experimenting on enslaved Black American women in the 1840s, and his legacy was only challenged over the past few decades. There's also the story of Henrietta Lacks, a Black American woman whose cancer cells were immortalized for medical research despite her family denying consent for their harvestation after her passing in 1951. Given the historical context of medical trials involving minority populations, it's not surprising to see a higher prevalence of hesitancy. Surveys conducted so far show that fewer than half of Black Americans were willing to receive the COVID-19 vaccine once it became available.
We see institutional and systemic racism in medical systems today across the United States. Black women are much more likely to die during childbirth than any other race or ethnicity. And so in this population, we see that this mistrust and this eventual hesitancy has very legitimate historical roots. So in that case, we do see some higher vaccine hesitancy among minority populations.
The distrust of the medical system is certainly widespread in minority populations. In Latinx American populations, only 34% trusted the vaccine's safety, while 40% trusted its effectiveness. In Black American populations, only 14% trusted its safety and 18% trusted its effectiveness. When you consider the fact that people of color in the US are disproportionately represented in infection, hospitalization, and death rates from COVID-19 compared to white Americans, vaccine hesitancy becomes an even more important challenge to overcome.
And then this anti-vax group is a completely and totally different group of people in general from some of the other sort of individuals on the spectrum of vaccine hesitancy. So if we look more towards the kind of standard anti-vax population, which tends to be predominantly white individuals, predominantly wealthier individuals, it can be rooted in ideas of sort of liberty and purity, this idea that I have the right to control what goes into my body and I only want to put things into my body that are pure and natural. And that's, you know, that's very, very different than from what we see in minority populations.
As Mallory alluded to earlier, there's a final group in the vaccine hesitant population, what the Chief Public Health Officer of Canada, Dr. Theresa Tam, calls the movable middle. If you're familiar with US presidential elections, these people are the swing states of vaccine hesitancy. States that Biden and Trump recently put in a lot of effort to win over, as they could reasonably end up voting for either party. The movable middle may be already up to date on their and their family's immunizations, and not anti-science by any means. However, unanswered questions and misinformation have caused this group to waver. And like Biden and Trump's swing states, Dr. Tam believes that this population will be critical to address in vaccine advocacy efforts.
A lot of vaccine hesitancy mostly arises just from having questions, having minor concerns, you know, they went through this development process very quickly, or I heard there might be some side effects of the vaccine. So that's sort of a more minor form of vaccine hesitancy, but it's still one that we have to address. And so that's kind of part of how we address vaccine hesitancy, is recognizing that there's sort of a wide variety of reasons why an individual might be vaccine hesitant and making sure that we're able to tailor our messages to an individual and their concerns. So I sort of mentioned a couple that have to do with the COVID-19 vaccines is, you know, there's concerns about how fast it was created. There is concerns about there being side effects because it's a new technology. Those are some of the kind of myths swirling around the COVID-19 vaccine. For something like the flu vaccine, things that we see most commonly are that the flu vaccine will give you the flu. And that's actually coming up with the COVID-19 vaccine as well, people being concerned that the vaccine will actually give you a coronavirus. For the HPV vaccine, for example, which is, you know, administered in adolescents to prevent a sexually transmitted disease, there's, you know, myths around like, oh, well, if you vaccinate a child, they're going to be more likely to engage in sexual activity earlier. You know, that is also a complete myth that has been debunked multiple times. So it really varies by vaccine, but a lot of different myths.
And of course, we can't forget about the myth that started the whole anti-vaxxer movement, that the mumps, measles, rubella vaccine, or the MMR vaccine could trigger autism in children. Needless to say, that myth has also been debunked by numerous studies and was retracted from publication. While vaccine hesitancy is certainly not a new phenomenon, the internet has had a huge impact on the spread of misinformation and myths about vaccines. If someone who is initially pro-vaccination is repeatedly exposed to misinformation online and on social media, they may begin to believe the misinformation due to the mere exposure effect, which is a development of preference towards something due to familiarity. Think back to when you first heard a song on the radio that you hated. After hearing it over and over again in the car or in the mall, you probably had a song grow on you eventually, like the song Baby Shark. Just kidding, that song still sucks, but I'm sure you can think of other songs that fit the bill. A rather harmless example, but that's you experiencing the mere exposure effect.
How vaccine misinformation spreads has drastically changed with how we communicate has drastically changed. And so you see a lot more spreading of misinformation on Facebook, on Twitter, on other social media sites. And you can see these sort of myths and rumors spread like wildfire and be perpetuated far more quickly than they ever were before. And even the myths themselves are sort of adapting to the new technology. One of the less credible myths around the coronavirus in general is that it's being spread by the 5G network. Technology has changed even what the myths and the misinformation are, as well as how they spread through communities.
Recognizing that vaccine hesitancy is a major threat to public health, governments around the world have found various ways to tackle vaccine hesitancy from a variety of avenues. For example, in 2015, the Liberian government recognized the influence of community leaders in gaining the trust of the public and trained community leaders to provide local education about the Ebola vaccine. In May of 2020, the Canadian government funded a digital literacy social media campaign called Check First, Share After, which aimed to educate the public about validating information found online before sharing it on social media. And in the UK, the National Health Service collaborated with Google, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook to help divert the public from unreliable news sources. However, while these systemic strategies can tackle vaccine hesitancy on a large-scale basis, we as the general population can also play a role in this effort by having conversations with vaccine-hesitant individuals around us. To learn more about how to engage in these conversations, we dove deeper into strategies and pitfalls regarding conversations about vaccine hesitancy.
Really, I think the foundation of any conversation about any topic where you find yourself in differing positions with someone, but is particularly true with vaccine hesitancy, is to start from a place of empathy and a place of common ground. So like I've said, for the vast majority of people who have some vaccine hesitancy, their concerns aren't unreasonable. Being concerned about side effects is not unreasonable. Being concerned about how fast the development process happened is not unreasonable. And usually those concerns are motivated by things that we all have in common. You know, are you concerned about your own personal safety, your own personal health, or you may be concerned about the health and safety of a loved one. So starting a conversation with someone who is vaccine hesitant, it's so important to start from a place of empathy and to start from a place of common ground. And from there, really just listening to the concerns that the person has and being prepared with sort of responses to those, responses to common misconceptions, common concerns. And I think another important thing is to share your own personal experience and your own personal thoughts. That goes back to empathy and finding common ground and just sharing sort of your own, you can share your own risk benefit calculation, like why, you know, if you've received the vaccine, why you chose to receive the vaccine, or if you haven't, you know, why when your time comes, you plan to receive the vaccine, you know, what is the risk benefit calculation that you're making in your head, so that that kind of can also share with them some information about how they may make their own risk benefit calculation. And we've seen evidence in numerous studies now that, I think this seems common sense, but telling someone that they're wrong doesn't necessarily work. And that this idea of sort of myth busting can actually backfire at times. So it's important to not, you know, necessarily just say, no, you're totally wrong. That's something you shouldn't be concerned about.
According to psychologists, one of the questions that people ask when presented with new information is whether it is compatible with their existing beliefs. This allows misinformation to be absorbed easily, but makes it difficult to undo an existing reliance on misinformation by presenting new, correct information. For example, the Listerine company had falsely claimed for decades that their mouthwash was effective against colds and sore throats. And although they were later forced to retract their claims in a multi-million-dollar advertising campaign for a 16-month period, 42% of Listerine consumers continued to believe the false claims, and 57% reported that these claims were a key factor when choosing to buy Listerine. In fact, attempting to correct or refute misinformation can even strengthen existing beliefs, as we instinctively defend information that challenges our views. This is known as the backfire effect.
Instead, provide additional information. We say, you know, you don't necessarily want to just like yank away their belief and not replace it with anything else. So if you are trying to kind of correct some misinformation or counter a myth that a person may believe, you know, making sure that you provide them with additional information as well. Another one is pretending to know something that you don't know. That's, I think, risk communication and health communication 101 is if you don't know, it's okay to say that you don't know. And it actually, again, can backfire if you try to pretend that you have more information than you have. Particularly, I'd say that's very relevant to the COVID-19 vaccine because there are a lot of unknowns. There are a lot of things that we don't know about them yet. So it's important to acknowledge that and important to be clear about, you know, what you know and don't know as an individual and sort of what is known and what we don't know about a vaccine in general.
It's also important to recognize that while these strategies can be implemented in any conversation about vaccine hesitancy, we may have varying degrees of success when engaging in these conversations, depending on the vaccine hesitant individual and their reasons for being hesitant. For example, the top two reasons for COVID-19 vaccine hesitancy in Canada are concerns about its safety or efficacy. Someone with these concerns may be swayed if their concerns are addressed with the right information. On the other hand, for the 9.7% of hesitant Canadians that do not believe in vaccines in general as a concept, it may be more difficult to convince them to first believe in vaccination and then also receive one.
I've had some, you know, just in personal conversations with friends and family, some extremely successful conversations where it was perhaps somebody who was open to the idea of vaccination, but perhaps was just had a few questions and a few concerns, and it really just took some reassurance. I have also encountered people in which I did not succeed personally. So it can really depend on sort of where a person is on the vaccine hesitancy scale. It can also depend a lot on sort of, are you the most appropriate messenger for this person? And that sort of ties back to this idea of trust being so central to vaccine hesitancy. So if it's someone who does have trust in the system, trust in sort of medical professionals, I would kind of send them to the CDC in the States, or y'all are in Canada, right? To the Canadian equivalent. A lot of my previous work has been working with pregnant women and vaccination during pregnant women. So I may turn to resources provided by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists as potential, you know, further resources. For a lot of people, their healthcare provider is their most trusted source of information. So I say that a lot when I'm having conversations is, you know, here's what I know and what I think, but go and chat with your doctor about this, or go and chat with a nurse or a midwife. And that can be another great resource of information for people. If it is someone who doesn't necessarily turn towards the medical system for their information, finding community resources, finding community leaders who are pro-vaccine, that varies a lot. So I don't necessarily know that I have immediate examples, but depending on sort of where you are and what community you're in, maybe you can be aware of other non-traditional health sources of vaccine information that you can also turn people to. And lastly, I think personal experience can be extremely helpful. So either your own personal experience or the experience of someone else in the community, sharing that can also help get the message across.
The concept of being or finding the appropriate messenger is key in conversations about vaccine hesitancy. Many members of the Wrigley community in Canada's Northwest Territories are looking to Premier Carolyn Cochrane and Chief Public Health Officer Dr. Cammy Condola to take the vaccine first. And Chief Stanley Sanges of Jean-Marie River is calling for community health nurses to come educate his community. It's hard to undo a long history of oppression and mistreatment, so it's important that we take these factors into account when trying to relay information about the vaccine. And this goes for all vaccine-hesitant individuals. We should try to understand and empathize with populations that have fears about the vaccine for any reason. When we're pursuing these difficult conversations, we should also remember to take care of ourselves. These conversations can be highly demanding, and if unsuccessful, can make us feel that we have very little control over the situation.
I think it's important if you find yourself kind of engaging in these conversations and finding them to be very difficult to also give yourself the space to kind of recover, because it's not easy. Even if it is someone who's a little easier to convince, it's a lot of emotional burden to try and sort of have any sort of discussion with someone who you strongly disagree. So if you need to ever take a break and just step back and say, okay, let's continue this discussion another time, or need to consider that maybe you're just not the person who's going to be able to convince this person to get vaccinated, that's also something important to consider in any sort of difficult conversation or form of communication.
We hope that this episode helped in giving you a better understanding of vaccine hesitancy and empowered you to feel ready to engage in conversations with vaccine hesitant individuals. Although these conversations can be difficult, you can make a big difference for someone and the people around them. Good luck out there, and remember to also take care of yourself. Thanks for listening to this episode of Hashtag Health. Keep an eye out for the second episode in this series, where we will discuss the creation of and mechanisms behind mRNA vaccines and answer some of the most common questions about the COVID-19 vaccine. If you enjoyed listening to our podcast, please consider giving us a rating or a review and subscribing to our show. You can also follow us on Instagram or Twitter at #healthpodcast, or like us on Facebook. This episode was written by me, your host, Patrick Kim, produced by Mary Nguyen, and edited by Mary Nguyen and Hugh Kim.